From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles.
I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. Public health officials are warning millions of people who are unvaccinated against COVID-19 about the risks of infection by the Omicron variant. That's even while they acknowledge that vaccines aren't foolproof, as Anthony Fauci, the country's top infectious disease doctor, explained to us on the program yesterday.
There have been breakthrough infections, a considerable number, as you might expect, because the vaccines are really geared to prevent clinically recognizable disease and not necessarily infection.
In Cleveland, Ohio, the leaders of six healthcare facilities recently took out a full-page newspaper ad urging people to get vaccinated. The ad had a one-word message: help. Dr. Robert Wiley is chief of medical operations at Cleveland Clinic. It's one of the hospitals that took out the advertisement. Dr. Wiley, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Your ad was published in Sunday's issue of the state's largest newspaper. That's the Plain Dealer. It has also been on social media and been passed around quite a bit. What prompted you to take out this ad or to cooperate in the effort?
What prompted us is we wanted to make sure that the public was aware of the strain that the Ohio hospitals are under, particularly in our area, Northeast Ohio. So if we just look at the numbers for a second, Ohio has the highest rate of testing positivity of any state in the United States at about nearly 20%. And we also have the highest rate of hospitalization adjusted for population. And if we look at where in Ohio the biggest problem occurs, it's actually in Cuyahoga County, which is Cleveland, Ohio, and in Summit County, which is the home of the city of Akron. And we're averaging in Cuyahoga County alone over 2,900 cases per day. And Summit County is averaging nearly 700 cases per day. So we wanted to make sure that there wasn't a disconnect between all the people being admitted to the hospital and coming down with COVID versus what the public is seeing out in their everyday life.
Fewer than 55% of residents in Ohio are fully vaccinated. And I know that as of this month, the Cleveland Clinic had to pause its system-wide vaccine policy as well. That was placed on hold. What do you think is causing this difficulty in convincing people to get vaccinated?
I think it's the same as large parts of the rest of the country. People have questions about the vaccine. They're not sure it was developed in a timeline that they're comfortable with. They have questions about what they hear in certain social media outlets about complications of getting the vaccine. So I think it's all of those type of things that everybody else is facing. And you're correct, we're about 55% vaccinated. So there's a great opportunity in Ohio to become more vaccinated.
Just the stark nature of that ad with just help in large letters. To me, it really fed into some of the messages I've seen from other healthcare providers, both physicians, nurses, medical techs, who say they're overwhelmed. Why that message in particular of help? What help do you need?
We wanted to keep it simple and direct and try to have it be impactful. The help we need is for people to reduce the number of COVID infections coming into the hospital. And we have a couple things which are different from the last surge last winter. One is that this is the highest number of COVID patients that we've had at any time during the pandemic. At Cleveland Clinic Hospitals this morning, we have nearly 900 active patients with COVID who are inpatients, and about a quarter of them are in the ICU. That's a tremendous number of patients. It's also complicated because we have the flu coming in and not many people are masking. And the third thing is that our caregivers, particularly with the Omicron infection, are getting infected as well. So we have about 1,700 caregivers out today in Northeast Ohio, either under quarantine or active infection. And we have a lot of employees, so that's about 2 to 3%. But 2 to 3% of employees, when we're already short-staffed, is a challenge. So what we need the public to do is to help us, to cooperate with us, and to get vaccinated. So it's not enough to think that, well, I'm not going to get vaccinated and I'll get COVID and I'll probably be okay. And even if hospitalized, I'm probably going to be okay, because we have so many patients currently in the hospital. Another reason to get vaccinated is to help us keep the numbers under control so that we can take care of everybody, not only who has COVID, but who has cancer and heart disease and anything else they're coming in for.
At the bottom of your ad, it says, "We need you to care as much as we do." What kind of response have you gotten to this plea for help?
Generally, it's been positive. We have seen an uptick in the people getting vaccinated, and we've gotten a fair amount of positive response from the public to the ad. I think this is an appeal to the community at large in that we need help for the entire community in order to provide medical care, not only for COVID, but for everything else.
Dr. Robert Wiley is Chief of Medical Operations at Cleveland Clinic. Doctor, thank you so much and good luck.
Thank you.
Let's get the latest now on the January 6th investigation. The House Select Committee wants to speak with one of former President Trump's closest allies, Congressman Jim Jordan. The committee sent Jordan a letter yesterday asking him to sit down and answer questions about his contact with the White House leading up to the insurrection. Here's Jordan talking about that request with Fox News anchor Brian Kilmeade.
I mean, we just got the letter today, Brian. We're going to review the letter, but I got to be honest with you. I got real concerns about any committee that will take a document and alter it and present it to the American people, completely mislead the American people like they did last week.
To help us understand this, let's bring in Ryan Riley, Senior Justice Reporter for HuffPost. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, so Jim Jordan was a key player in promoting that the 2020 election results were a fraud. He was also one of the GOP lawmakers trying to push Vice President Mike Pence to overturn the election. We just heard Jordan refer to a document. What is he talking about?
Yeah, so Jim Jordan actually sent this text message to Mark Meadows, who was then the White House Chief of Staff, about sort of laying out a legal theory for how essentially Mike Pence could object to the certification of the Electoral College vote. Now, what Jordan is sort of saying there is that this was a text forward. Apparently, he got some sort of message from a former Department of Defense Inspector General, in fact, that laid out this legal theory, and Jordan passed it along. He was sort of forwarding the text message. So when he's talking about this idea that he believes that the committee is misrepresenting what that message actually said, he's basically saying that this was a text forward. This wasn't his original text that he wrote himself.
Understood. Okay, Jordan is the second GOP lawmaker the committee has asked to interview this week. We know that Pennsylvania Congressman Scott Perry already said he wouldn't speak with the committee. Do you expect Jordan to do something similar?
It's questionable because, I mean, Jim Jordan is somebody who really loves the cameras. So there's the potential that he can sort of make a stink about this either way. He can either make an objection to testifying before them at all, or he can make a show of testifying before them. I'm not sure which way he's going to go with it, but it does get into this sort of dicier legal territory when you talk about subpoenaing a sitting member of Congress. It's something that you could easily see being argued out through the court system, and you can basically extend out this argument for a very long period of time, well after this investigation is going to have to be wrapped up.
Right. To your point, it's important to note that these are voluntary requests. Subpoenas for sitting members of Congress are pretty rare because members of Congress usually have deference to each other as fellow lawmakers. How likely is it that the Select Committee, though, would subpoena Jordan should he not want to cooperate, or any lawmakers it wants to hear from?
There's the potential there, but, you know, you do see this legal battle unfolding with a lot of people who have been targets of this investigation. They're putting it in the court system, and essentially it's a strategy of delay, because if you can just extend out this investigation a little bit, sort of muck this up and tie it up in the courts, there's a very good chance that, you know, the expiration date for this committee is going to come up before that litigation is settled. They really are on a pretty tight timeline here. A lot of predictions show that Republicans will likely take back the House next year in 2022. That means early 2023, they'll have control of the House in most likelihood. So this committee really does have an expiration date. And in order to get this investigation finished in time, they really do have to stick to this timeline. So putting this thing through the legal system actually is a pretty worthwhile strategy for them. It actually might mess up the investigation in the end.
While I have you, I want to talk with you a little bit more about the people who rioted at the Capitol that day. A Proud Boys member who was one of the first people to cross the Capitol Police line has pleaded guilty and has agreed to cooperate with the government. With the minute I have with you, what more do we know about him?
Yeah, so Matthew Green, he's 34. He's from Syracuse, New York, and he was part of this sort of New York-based entity of the Proud Boys, a sort of chapter of the Proud Boys that went down to the Capitol. The Proud Boys conspiracy case is one of the larger of the January 6th investigations. There's sort of two big conspiracy cases, the Proud Boys one and then the Oath Keepers one. So this was a major breakthrough for prosecutors here. But you have to remember that we're really at the beginning stages still of this investigation. About 700 people have been charged, but in reality, that's only about a quarter of the people who could be charged for their conduct that day, whether that means they entered the Capitol building or whether that means they fought with law enforcement officers outside. Nevertheless, this is a big breakthrough in this individual conspiracy case and could have some implications for that investigation going forward.
A lot to follow. Ryan Riley is a senior justice reporter for the HuffPost. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
50 years ago this week, President Nixon signed into law the National Cancer Act. The goal? Invest in medical research with the hope of finding a cure for cancer in just 5 years.
And I hope that in the years ahead, that we may look back on this day and this action as being the most significant action taken during this administration.
Of course, there is still no cure for cancer, but where has that war on cancer led us? Joining us now is Otis Brawley, former chief medical officer for the American Cancer Society and currently a professor of oncology and epidemiology at Johns Hopkins University. Doctor, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Let's remind people, 50 years ago, half of all Americans diagnosed with cancer died from it. People were scared to talk about it. I mean, we have come a long way.
We actually have. It was called the Big C. Some people couldn't even say the name of the disease, and it was incredibly feared. And it still does hurt a large number of people, but we have made significant progress. We've had a 31% decline in the relative risk of death since 1991, much of it attributed to the National Cancer Act.
At the same time, cancer historian Judith Pearson, for example, writes that Nixon's war on cancer is a magnificently fruitful failure because while there are so many advances, as you're talking about in research and treatment, there is still no cure. How do you see it?
I see cancer as a number of different diseases, perhaps 200 different diseases. Some of the advances that we've made through the National Cancer Act have developed additional treatments. Some have developed additional screening. Perhaps the most important thing to come out of the National Cancer Act is an understanding of what cancer is and what causes cancer. And that leads us to the ability to prevent a lot of cancers. You know, I now know that we can prevent at least 50% of all cancers, going beyond smoking, which was known to be a cause of cancer when Nixon signed the National Cancer Act. We now know that about 30% of cancers are due to energy imbalance, obesity, not enough exercise, and consuming too many calories, for example. We know about viruses in cancer, the HPV vaccination, which has the potential of preventing many head and neck cancers and cervical cancers. The thing that I like to stress is what we can do in the field of prevention or risk reduction is not just screening and treatment, although screening and treatment
right.
so much of the airway.
To your point here, Dr. Deborah Davis, back in 2007, wrote a book called The Secret History of the War on Cancer, and she argued that we're fighting the wrong war by focusing on treatment and leaving out things that cause it, like tobacco and alcohol and our environment. Where are we on prevention?
You know, we have learned so much about what causes cancer and so much about how to reduce risk for cancer. But unfortunately, people don't really want to grasp it. You know, you hear a great deal about how great prevention is, but actually practicing prevention, getting into studying how you motivate society to do the right thing. Unfortunately, that's the downfall. And I must tell you, what came out of the National Cancer Act over the last 50 years is just amazing molecular biology, just amazing understanding of what cancer is, a total redefinition of what cancer is. You know, what we thought cancer was in 1960 and what we think it is in 2021 is totally different. And much of that actually does lead back to that prevention thing as being the low-hanging fruit, the opportunity that needs to be exploited.
But on this topic of prevention, do you feel that the medical industry has gone far enough with educating people on prevention methods?
You know, I do not feel the medical industry has gone far enough. I frequently say that the way to prevent cancer is to improve the education that's provided to people in second and third grade. We need to teach people ways of living a healthy life. That involves consumption of 5 to 9 servings of fruits and vegetables per day. That involves exercise, 30 minutes of good exercise at least 5 times a week for adults, and even more than that for children. Of course, not smoking as well, including not using e-cigarettes or marijuana. These things that I'm talking about, these health promotion things, prevent cancer. They also prevent the other chronic diseases like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and even orthopedic injury. So we really do need to stress prevention. One of the problems is, how do you make money off of prevention? And when I say make money off of prevention, I mean, how does one make a living off of it? And by the way, prevention is not taking vitamins or taking supplements or something like that. It's simply a good balanced diet with exercise and avoiding well-known carcinogens.
This intersects with another big issue when we talk about the war on cancer, and that's disparities. Black people have higher death rates than all other racial groups in the U.S. for many cancers, including breast and prostate cancer. There are so many contributing factors here: poverty, access to medical care, differences in treatment, education about a healthy diet. Are we doing everything we can to improve that?
Well, you know, the most recent data really is striking about that. For example, if we look at breast cancer, there are 5 states in the United States where Black-white breast cancer death rates are the same. That indicates that we can do a great deal more for breast cancer for Black women. American Cancer Society epidemiologists actually suggest that if we get everything that we currently know people should get, from prevention all the way, or risk reduction all the way through appropriate screening and appropriate treatment, 130,000 of the 600,000 cancer deaths that are going to occur this year would not occur. And by the way, 80,000 of that 130,000 deaths are in white Americans. So when we talk about health disparities, a Black or poor person or Hispanic person in the United States is more likely to suffer from those health disparities, but the largest group to suffer from health disparities are white Americans.
And you know, over the last 50 years, there have been many initiatives. Back in 2016, President Obama called on then Vice President Biden to lead what he called a cancer moonshot to eliminate cancer. Let's listen.
I believe that the United States of America should be the country that ends cancer once and for all. We're already closer than a lot of folks think, and this bill will bring us even closer, investing in promising new therapies, developing vaccines, and improving cancer detection and prevention.
How will we look back on that moment at its 50-year anniversary?
Well, in many respects, what came out of the National Cancer Act that many people don't totally appreciate is a momentum that developed new knowledge about what cancer is, as well as training of a large force of people, primarily in molecular biology and cellular biology. That has led to a number of people in the biotech industry. You know, the biotech industry blossomed because of the National Cancer Act. Today, more research is done by private companies than done by the U.S. government funded through universities. I happen to think that we've learned a great deal and we can apply a great deal more, but implementation science is something we also need to think about. Implementation science is how do we get the fruits of what we're developing to all the people? But I'm very optimistic. You know, one thing I should point out is the death rate from colorectal cancer today is literally 50% of what it was in 1981. Your average American, the risk of dying from colon cancer is half what it was 40 years ago. The death rate for women in the United States from breast cancer is 40% of what it was in 1990. You know, so we are making some progress, and it really ought to give us a little bit more encouragement that we can make more progress. By the way, I do worry about the research efforts. You know, 10% of grants going to the National Institutes of Health that are judged worthy of funding are actually getting funded right now. We have a lot of research ideas that are really good, but they don't get funded. So I do worry about the future.
Well, what do you see the priority to be over the next 50 years?
I think over the next 50 years, or I hope I should say, that we will focus more and more on risk reduction. It's also doing such things as breastfeeding. For example, we've got data to show that women who have children and don't breastfeed increase their risk of some of the bad types of breast cancer. Indeed, this is part of the reason why Black women have a higher risk of triple negative, more aggressive breast cancer. It's really poor women who tend not to breastfeed. So I'm hoping that we can focus more on the things that we can do to live a healthy life.
Otis Brawley is former chief medical officer of the American Cancer Society and professor at Johns Hopkins University. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Oh, it's my privilege.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
New COVID cases in Japan have dropped so fast in recent months, it seems almost too good to be true. It doesn't look like Japan's previous waves of infections, and it doesn't look like other countries that are in situations similar to Japan's. As NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports, experts are struggling to explain why.
In late August, Japan was seeing more than 25,000 new COVID cases a day. The medical system was stretched to its limits, and the situation looked grim to Dr. Hideaki Oka. But by late September, cases had plunged, so Oka is getting a respite.
We have had zero COVID patients in our hospital for 2 months straight, so we've been able to concentrate on general medicine, just as in pre-COVID times.
Cases dropped by more than 99% from their peak. Japan recorded less than one death a day for weeks, their lowest level since July 2020. Dr. Norio Omagari of Japan's National Center for Global Health and Medicine summed up the situation in Tokyo at a government meeting on December 9th.
We've had below 50 new daily cases on average for 8 weeks. We think it is due to countermeasures taken by many citizens and institutions, and accelerated vaccination, thanks to medical staff's efforts and citizens' understanding.
After previous waves of infections, almost as soon as local governments lifted their states of emergencies, cases began to rebound. That hasn't happened this time, although cases appear to be creeping back up. Dr. Hideaki Oka says that one thing that's changed is that Japan's government speeded up its vaccine rollout ahead of the Olympics, and nearly 80% of its population of 125 million people is now fully vaccinated. The vaccine is one barrier keeping the virus at bay. Oka says that it's a social norm in Japan to keep another kind of barrier over people's mouths and noses.
Even though I keep having no COVID patients, I haven't seen anybody on the street in Japan not wearing masks. Even though they think it may not be necessary, there is pressure for people to do the same as everyone else.
But Japan's neighbor, South Korea, has fully vaccinated more than 90% of its adult population, and masking up in public is the norm here, too. Yet South Korea is going through its worst wave of infections of the pandemic so far. Media and scientific journals have published theories that argue that beyond masks and vaccines, there may be something about Japan's people and environment that have helped them to keep cases and deaths low by international standards.
One hypothesis is that there's something intrinsically different about the immune cells that the Japanese people might carry that is able to fight off the infection.
Akiko Iwasaki is an immunologist at Yale University. She mentions another theory which says that there are other coronaviruses already in Japan which give people some immunity to COVID. Yet another theory holds that the Delta variant in Japan has mutated so that it's less harmful than elsewhere. Iwasaki says these arguments may be interesting, but they're not necessarily correct.
We just have some tidbits of information that may support these theories, but currently these are not proven theories.
Dr. Hideaki Oka agrees. Japan has barred non-resident foreigners from entering the country to keep out new strains of the virus. But Oka says the restrictions are unsustainable.
Even if the theories are right, it is not possible for Japan to keep the country closed. The reality is another wave will definitely come.
And as soon as the next wave of infections hits, he says, it will lay to rest any speculation that Japan is somehow exceptional when it comes to COVID. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
Journalist Dawn Turner has had a successful career, years as a columnist for the Chicago Tribune. She's held several prestigious fellowships and published a couple of novels. But as she writes in her latest book, Turner has always been haunted by the fates of her younger sister Kim and best friend Deborah, two women who grew up with as much promise as Dawn did, but whose lives went in drastically different directions. Turner writes about all three of their lives in the memoir Three Girls from Bronzeville. It was published to great acclaim in September and was recently named one of the New York Times 100 Notable Books of the Year. So congratulations, but also Dawn Turner, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh my goodness, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So let's start with Bronzeville itself, the location. In the beginning of the book, you write, "To understand Deborah, Kim, and me, to understand what will happen to us, you have to know the place that has begun to shape us. We live in Chicago's historic Bronzeville community at 3 square miles. It's the cradle of the city's great migration, the epicenter of Black business and culture." So tell us about Bronzeville and why it becomes a central character in your book.
Oh, yes, absolutely. My great-grandparents arrived in Chicago with my grandmother in 1916 as part of the first wave of the Great Migration. And as more and more Blacks arrived, they were confined to this narrow strip of land on the near south side of the city, and it was called the Black Belt. And as that belt expanded, the area was later affectionately known as Bronzeville. And in the beginning, Chicago did feel like the promised land, but soon white homeowners moved and chopped up their stately homes to be used as kitchenette apartments, and the buildings fell into horrible disrepair, and the city neglected the area. And yet, my grandmother would later tell us that the new residents did what Black folks have always done, took a bunch of scraps and stitched together a world. Some of the country's most esteemed Black people lived in Bronzeville. Gwendolyn Brooks, the first Black person to win the Pulitzer Prize. The novelist Richard Wright lived there. And Dr. Daniel Hale Williams, a Black man who was the first heart surgeon to perform the very first successful heart surgery. So not the first Black heart surgeon, but the first heart surgeon. And so Deborah, Kim, and I, when we were coming of age there, we inherited a legacy of innovation and excellence moments, but the community was also deformed by a history of redlining and restrictive housing covenants. So this made some places simply unsafe and some dreams for some of the residents there simply unattainable.
So let's talk about Deborah and Kim. Kim is your younger sister, and when she's introduced in the book, she's very much what we would recognize as a younger sister to be, nipping at your heels all the time. And then your best friend, Deborah. Can you tell us a little bit more about your childhood together? Because the theme of the book seems to be that you started from the same sort of crucible with very different results.
We were, I was 3 years old in 1968 when I met my sister. She, from the very beginning, was a mystery to me, headstrong, stubborn, so, so willful. I was 7 years old when I first met Deborah. We went to the same elementary school, and I would watch her from afar because she also was stubborn and willful. And I was actually very different. I was more quiet. And for me, rules were scaffolding, but we found each other. And I mean, I didn't have a whole lot of say in regarding my sister, but Deborah and I became best friends in the third grade. And we learned that we not only lived in the same apartment complex, but her apartment was directly above mine. And we had so much in common. We were both readers, avid readers, and we loved the children's book character Pippi Longstocking. And in the spirit of Pippi, we roamed our neighborhood trying to find things for our Thing Finders Club that we believed could be made whole and new again.
What was the moment in your life when you thought to yourself, things are going to be different? Things are different right now for Kim and for Deborah. We're going in different directions.
It was probably around adolescence, and that is a fraught period for a lot of kids. It was a time when we had to kind of make a decision in terms of our friendships and our education. When I was younger, I mean, just it seems like from the very beginning, my teachers told me that I was really smart and that I should go to college. And Deborah and Kim were incredibly smart, but they were not necessarily told that because they were both willful, and they turned in homework as they kind of felt like it sometimes. So teachers kind of focused more on that with them than it was how smart they were. And so I felt so strongly about heading in the direction of college. And my friends kind of were of that same ilk in terms of heading in that direction as well. And Kim's and Deborah's friends were a little more, they kind of liked the edge a little bit more than, that's what they were attracted to.
So all three of you grew up in this neighborhood. And I understand that one of the reasons that motivated you to write this memoir was when you wanted to write a column about Deborah. I'm kind of struggling here because I don't want to give away any of the plot points of the book, but neither Kim nor Deborah have a happy ending. You wanted to write a column about Deborah, and your editor said that could never have been you.
Right.
What did you think when he said that? Do you remember?
I felt like it was, it had to do with white privilege, or this idea that you can work super hard and you can make some pretty good decisions, and then you're guaranteed to have a certain kind of life. And as an African-American person in this country, we're not so sure of that. I felt strongly then and now that there but for the grace of God go I, when I think about my sister and I think about my best friend. And it's easy to say, well, oh, that could never have been you. But you know, life can change in an instant, and you never know the moment when that can happen and how that can happen. For my sister, she was in mourning for a long time. And for Deborah, she had other issues that she was dealing with.
You start the book with this description of the three of you as children. And, you know, you describe an incident in which Deborah jumps down this relatively high, for children anyway, high ledge, and wants you to do it as well. And you say no. And you describe them both as being the kind of person that says, you can't tell us what to do. And in a way, that's this admirable quality for these kids, like the courage of youth. And yet one of the beauties, the magic of this book is you kind of show us how that kind of attitude sometimes doesn't age well. Sometimes risk is just risk.
It is right. It is an admirable quality if you can manage it. And yeah. There's almost this kind of, can you walk up to the edge and not go over? And that becomes the challenge. And I think that that's a tricky tightrope type maneuver, especially for Black people and especially for Black girls.
What do you want people to take away from these stories of you and your sister and your friend?
I hope readers see this as a story with a lot of universal themes centering on transcendence, grit, resilience, and second chances regarding who gets them and who doesn't. There's no question that Deborah and Kim charted their own path and that they had their own ideas regarding what they wanted to do with their lives. They made some bad choices, but we all do. And part of who makes it in this life depends on whether we can survive our bad choices. If I look over my life, I can identify the moments when luck intervened, when grace intervened. And I think that that's important in terms of how we look at people and how we dole out empathy.
I wonder what you have taken away from this process. We both know that writing a book is sometimes a very long and torturous process. You're going back and back and back over the same passages. After all of that, examining in such detail your young life and the life of your friend and your sister, has your view of them changed?
I think I love them more. I am amazed by the hard work that Deborah has done. She was able to transform her life in such a way that I think it would be remarkable for anybody. I respect them, and I've learned more about myself through them.
Dawn Turner's book is Three Girls from Bronzeville, a uniquely American memoir of race, fate, and sisterhood. Dawn Turner, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
This winter, as coronavirus cases spike, restaurant owners throughout the country are worried about staying in business. There is no more federal relief money on the immediate horizon, and that just adds to a situation that's growing more dire each day as staff members of restaurants get sick and COVID tests are in short supply. Joining us now is Steve Postol, owner of Commonwealth Restaurant in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Steve, I know this is a make it or break it time of year for businesses like yours. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
When we last spoke with you in August, you opened your restaurant again, but struggled with higher food costs and supply chain issues that led to basically a shortage of takeout containers. And you said back then that the future was really bad. How are you doing now?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the calls of the doom that were coming are no longer, because the doom is here. It's here. It's awful. And it's terrible.
Will you be able to stay open? What is your plan?
Commonwealth is currently closed right now. We had planned on opening in early January, but it's not looking good.
Can you explain for us some of what you've been dealing with in the last few weeks?
Yeah, sure. I mean, positive COVID tests from staff members, close contacts with staff members that have roommates or that have been tested positive and can't find any tests anywhere. My wife drove around last night looking for tests. She went to 9 pharmacies. She found one box. I go every day and there's no tests. I mean, as a business owner, like I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Like I'm not the Department of Public Health. Like I don't know what to do. There's really no guidance. There's no testing. There's no funding to help me. There's just like, you're on your own. Good luck. It's not sustainable any longer.
And we should note that you're talking about staff members who are fully vaccinated and some of them boosted.
Double vax and boosted, getting positive breakthrough cases. And I mean, I don't know a single restaurant in the city of Boston that doesn't have a positive case. If they don't, they're either not testing or they're lying.
Anecdotally, we've also been hearing some of the same things from restaurants all across the country who are struggling to stay afloat. What else are you hearing from your restaurant community in Cambridge and greater Boston?
I mean, I'm just hearing that people are just done. They're done with it's not worth it any longer. A lot of people are closing. They're not reopening. And shame on the federal government for promising funds to help us get through this and just not delivering.
You feel that the government has abandoned you, essentially. Money from the Federal Restaurant Relief Fund dried up earlier this year. Some restaurants got a lot of money. Others, like yours, received just a little or basically none. Lawmakers in Washington are proposing to replenish that money. What would you say to them if you could speak to them right now?
I would say to them that you've waited too long, and you have to do it right now. There's a bill that Senator Cardin and Senator Wicker from Maryland and Mississippi has bipartisan support. You have to pass it, and you have to pass it right now. You can't wait any longer. You've actually already waited too long. I wanted them to act, you know, way back when we told them about it. And, you know, they had no problem finding $800 billion for the military. They got no problem finding money. Like, it is an embarrassment. I'm embarrassed to be an American citizen with that government. It's beyond words that they know what the problem is, they know what the solution is, and they can't do it.
You say that you're basically going to close. I mean, this restaurant, though, is your livelihood.
Yeah, I mean, it's not only is it my livelihood, but it's all the people that work there. You know, we have, you know, it's the supply people, it's the dairy guy, it's the farmers, it's the linen guy, it's the bussers, it's the dishwashers, it's so many people. And the fact that they haven't replenished the RRF and they would give so much money to so few people and give nothing to everybody else is just unfathomable to me. It's cruel. It's just unfathomable.
Your call to action at this point, since you have so many positive workers, is for the government to intervene and help you and other restaurant owners stay afloat financially. It looks like you'll have to close until you're able to get these cases under control. That's what you're asking for.
Basically, yeah. I mean, we need testing. We need funds. You know, I can tell you who's not complaining right now, who's not whining, are the 30% of restaurants that receive the RRF. They're fine. Plus, they're able to pay their workers more. They're able to pay for higher prices for goods. And then there's the 70% of restaurants that got nothing and are like, okay, you guys are good. People are about to lose their jobs. I mean, you go on the internet now, go on Instagram and look, and restaurants are closing left and right. As fast as you can scroll, they're closing. And the government knew this was coming. They knew it was going to happen. They knew they had to give us funding, and they didn't deliver it. And they should be replaced with people who can do a better job because they're doing a terrible job.
Steve Postol is owner of Commonwealth Restaurant in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, thank you so much for talking with us, and I wish you the best to you and to your staff members.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles.
I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now.